You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
My thesis is that the recession changed the mindset of the upcoming generation, where kids who were 10, 12, whatever, when their parents were getting laid off in 2008, internalized this thing that they maybe not have been able to even articulate, but was that nobody is going to take care of you but you. It's on you.
You know, and the evidence is in the numbers. You know, there's 1,000 questions about money and entrepreneurship. And I think also people understand that money isn't just about what's in your account. Like there's almost like a power to money. Like you need to think about how you think about money. It can't just be, am I going up or am I going down? It's like, should I do a prenup? Is debt a deal killer in a relationship? Like, what are the different powers behind money and what you could do with it? Like, should you be gifting? How do you think about tipping? Like, all these kind of social contracts we have in society and ideas are worth thinking about and understanding to really understand money, as opposed to, again, did my brokerage account go up today? Did it go down? And that defines you as a person. Now we'll start.
It's good to have the chit chat.
So excited about this podcast. My old friend, Nicole Lapin.
Calling old.
Yeah, well, we've known each other since what? 2005, 2006? When did you start at CNBC?
Yeah, a decade ago.
Yeah, so at least since you were the 5 a.m. anchor on CNBC.
Yeah.
And you were great. Everyone loved you. And then I was on once a week, basically, for I don't know how long it was, but I was on once a week. It was like a regular thing. And we would have so much fun basically analyzing the markets when nobody in the United States was watching. But you tell me, everybody in Europe was watching. So
totally. But there was like no oversight in the US. None of the executives were watching, so we caused so much trouble.
Right. Like you basically, like normally when I remember and by the way, also my new friend as of just this past year, Jason Pfeiffer, editor-in-chief at Entrepreneur Magazine. Welcome,
hey.
Jason.
Thank you for having me.
And you guys are doing a podcast together called Hush Money. So we're going to talk about every fun, relatable issue of money, such a topic near and dear to my heart. But I was going to say, normally when people go on TV, they're a little nervous, right? Like the very first time I was on CNBC, I was scared out of my mind. And then I got used to it, but going on, we would go on for an hour. You're an expert, Nicole, so you know everything. But for me, going on an hour at 5 a.m, it was like, who gives a shit? Like, we could say whatever we want, like, at 5 a.m. No
True
one.
Story.
I mean, people were listening. Like, you would see tweets and stuff. Like, people were listening, but it was just more fun. People were listening because they knew we were having fun with it. And that's the best way to do TV, I think.
Yeah, and it's the best way to be at 5 a.m. I mean, is there anything else to do but have so much fun?
I mean, we're going to talk about Hush Money in a second, but what time did you have to wake up every day?
I didn't go to bed. That's the thing.
Like, did you ever sleep?
Not really. So for a while, I was doing like Kudlow's show too. So I was doing the very first show.
I was doing once a week on Kudlow's show.
See? And then I'd go back and forth because we were in Jersey at the time. And so when I first moved to New York, like I knew nobody. I was 25. Like I didn't come from this world. You know my whole spiel. And I needed to source and like book guests. So I'd go out at night. And then I'd go straight from like being out at dinner to the studio. And I may or may not have had like wine and whatever. So that's what made it more fun. That's what made 5 a.m.'s more interesting.
I think that should be, you know, your next book is 5 a.m.'s
drinking
were interesting
on the air. It's
So wait, and then
you
what?
Had
then
to.
You'd go. Then you'd go home and sleep then, at noon.
Yeah, and then I did like all the other shows, so Morning Joe and a bunch of like Today Show and whatever. When those shows came on after my show was over at 6 a.m. And then I would go do stories. Like I'd fly and interview the governor of Washington State and come back and like go to Kudlow. And like I just slept 1 hour. So my body just shut down.
Yeah, you know, this is a job only a 25-year-old could do.
That's true. Like, yeah, like messing like, up your body rhythm is...
Did you actually feel any effects from that? Did you get sick?
I got sick all the time. Like my body just shut down. Like I felt jet lagged all the time. I felt like my skin was tingling. I randomly had pink eye and like a tooth infection. My body was like, fuck you. Like,
that's all, and that's all stress related, right? Like totally. All those things
hives,
are
like,
related to stress.
Yeah.
So, but it's interesting though, because like you say you went on these other shows. It's because like most anchors don't go on other shows. I feel like if someone's like the anchor at 11 a.m., all right, they're just replaced at noon with the next anchor. But because you were the only anchor awake when news was breaking so early in the morning all around the world, it made sense that you would then go on Good Morning America. There, everybody's just waking up. You've already been like, you know, neck deep in the markets for 5 hours. It makes sense that you would then go on these morning shows and inform people what's going on. So you become both an anchor and an expert at the same time.
Yeah, I went on the Golf Channel when Comcast bought NBC, and I still have like the craziest, most rabid golf following. It's so weird. So like some of the executives called me in and they were like, we have a really big thing to tell you. And I was like, oh, I'm going to be in the face of NBC News. Like, this is going to be amazing. Billboards and buses. They're like, we want you to be on the Golf Channel. I was like, where is Ashton? What the fuck is going on? Am I getting punked? They're like, no, Brian Roberts, like who ran Comcast, like loves the Golf Channel. And so this is this crossover effort. So I was like, this is a joke. Like, I'm just going to go on. Like, I don't know about your birdies and eagles dudes. Like, whatever you guys do on the golf course, like, I'm here to tell you about the Dow. But it became this shtick thing. And people are now like, yeah, where are you from the Golf Channel?
Also, you figure who's watching the Golf Channel? It's investors
Same.
Are watching the Golf Channel.
Like,
yeah. It's Same. Not like, other than like, you know, golf caddies or whatever who are obsessed with golf. Like, who's it's, playing golf? It's people who are like retired doctors.
Guys, yeah, guys who care about money and chicks and sports. And it like flips for one and two with highest net worth viewing audience for sure.
Wow.
Yeah. So I would go and explain what happened overnight in the markets and probably what James and I like riffed on, which were, you know, by the way, like closing bell in Asia, middle of day in Europe, like the whole world is awake.
It wasn't like we were idiots. I thought those were the best shows I ever did on CNBC.
Aww.
So, because every other point, you've been on a lot also, Jason, mm-hmm. like you get like 3 minutes to talk about all of your opinions and it's just not a real conversation.
No.
You know, and it's like just intended, like, can we get the conversation antagonistic enough so we can get it to the next ad spot? Oh, there we are. Okay, now get line up the next people. And you know, those times at like 5 a.m. or even things like podcasts, like you know, we're going to talk about your Hush Money podcast. That's when you can have a real conversation that's in depth. And you know what I love about your podcast so much is that it's not, you're not just talking about like, oh, well, here's the statistics on, you do talk about statistics, but it's not just here's the statistics on this problem. It's like your personal experiences, and you know, you get very transparent about your lives and your backgrounds. And I think that's new for a financial podcast, and it's a great thing because listeners don't want to hear pundits. They want to hear your story. What did you do? Like, you know, let's go into one of the issues right now. This is the one you had Dr. Oz on, so you have great guests on as well. Prenup or not when you get married. So, you know, Donald Trump, of course, the president of the United yeah. States, always advises in his books for the past 30 years, you must get a prenup or you'll go broke, because he's been divorced so many times, he gets prenups. And you had differing opinions. And I'm just curious, like, what, first of all, by the way, first of all, how did you decide to do this podcast before we get into prenups?
Opening with prenups. It starts with Nicole. I mean, my start was that I got a text from Nicole saying, do you want to do a podcast?
I was in Cannes and I just had like a bottle of rosé or something.
I feel like you name dropped that. Like you were at the most important film festival all time.
Oh,
just hanging out.
No. I was at the Nerd Cannes. I was at Cannes Lion. I was not at the film festival. That is far too cool for me for sure. So I was doing like nerd stuff with a bunch of advertisers and whatever. And we had just seen each other at a conference mm-hmm. and And I was like, I should do a podcast. I mean, James has been telling me for a decade to do a podcast. I feel like maybe our show was like pre-podcast. It was like podcast on the
air. Because we had an hour to just talk.
Riffed about whatever. And so I hadn't done a podcast and I saw Jason. And most of the stuff I do is like chicky stuff. So, you know, I talk to women about money. And I never did a show with a guy. And I was like, Jason's like the dude version of me, which I'm sorry.
I take that as a nice compliment.
I'm sorry to interrupt because I'll expand on what she said. You know, you're editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. I feel like the world has shifted from, hey, should I buy Apple stock or not? To, hey, what's the right business I should start? Or can I start a business? Or how do I quickly start a business? Or what side hustle I can do? I feel like these next generations are much more interested, correctly, I think, in entrepreneurial thinking than, oh, is Google a good buy? Which is so kind of mindless, ultimately.
Totally. My thesis is that the recession changed the mindset of the upcoming generation, where kids who were 10, 12, whatever, when their parents were getting laid off in 2008, internalized this thing that they maybe not have been able to even articulate, but was that nobody is going to take care of you but you. And then you get old enough to put that into action. And what that means is to have a vision and control your future. And the people that you then idolize are the people who already did that, who went out and built something for themselves and really controlled it and had a vision. And that's so different from, right, like throwing money into Google, because you can't control that. You can like read and whatever, but it's gambling, right? It's gambling. It's not controlling your future. But entrepreneurship is, as best anybody can, because of course there's no guarantees in entrepreneurship, but you are putting all your chips in on yourself. And I think that people find that very satisfying. And they, in a way, despite the crazy roller coaster that entrepreneurship is, it is calming in a way because it's on you. It's on you. You're not at the whim of some giant company that may or may not want to employ you tomorrow. It's on you.
You know, and the evidence is in the numbers. Like in 2009, something like $100 billion was in what are called exchange-traded funds, which are stocks that just move with the entire market. Like, you don't have to think about stocks, they just move with the market. And now $4 trillion is invested in those, which just shows that people don't care. They're just passively, those are just savings accounts, just putting money in those things. And so you're right. I think most of the questions I get, for instance, in my daily activities are about like, okay, would you look at this business? Or what do you think of this business idea? Or what did you do when you first started a business? Like, you know, there's 1,000 questions about money and entrepreneurship. And I think also people understand that money isn't just about what's in your account. I'm curious what you guys think of this. It's not just about the number in your account. Like there's almost like a power to money. Like you need to think about how you think about money. It can't just be, am I going up or am I going down? It's like, should I do a prenup? Should I, is debt a deal killer in a relationship? Like what are the different powers behind money and what you could do with it? Like, should you be gifting? How do you think about tipping? Like what, all these kind of social contracts we have in society and ideas are worth thinking about and understanding to really understand money, as opposed to, again, did my brokerage account go up today? Did it go down? And that defines you as a person.
Yeah. I think Nicole had come up with this line that we maybe used in the intro of our show. I can't remember. Which is that if you're not talking about money, you're not making it. And
I love that.
Yeah. I really like that line because if you don't have a philosophy for yourself about how you manage your money and think about it and think about the way that money impacts and influences your life, then you're not going to be strategic about it. And that's not just talking about investing. That's talking about everything. Because if you don't know what your philosophy is, then you're going to be afraid to make decisions at the time when you really need to make a decision. And that decision could be a business decision or it could be a personal decision. And you need to know where you stand on these things. And I think a lot of people don't. I think that's the power of talking about it, is that people want to hear other people talk about it because they're afraid to talk about it themselves.
Yeah, and I think also, like, what people sometimes might hear that and they might think, oh, philosophy about money. Okay, I'm either, I either spend a lot or I'm frugal or I'm miserly, you know, but I think there's a lot more subtleties and nuances in that. It's like kind of taking care of your money in is important as opposed to saying, oh, I'm always going to be frugal or I'm always going to spend and give when I can. And, you know, I think there's, again, a lot of nuances. And you talk about this in your podcast. Like, we'll get into gifting, tipping, all this stuff. But again, prenups is something everyone, every couple talks about at some point. A friend of mine recently got married and the prenup was a huge issue. I recently got married. I'm about to have my first anniversary. It wasn't an issue in for us at all, but I do know many cases where it was such a strong issue, like it was relationship threatening. So I know where you stand already, but how about you? And this is just an example of one of your podcasts. We'll talk about a bunch of them and other stuff, but where do you stand, Jason, on the prenup thing?
So I'm married. I got married in 2011 and we don't have a prenup. And it never occurred to us to talk about it. It was understood by both my wife, Jen, and I, that this was not something we were going to do. Now, we both, for what it's worth, entered the relationship at fairly equal financial footing. So there wasn't a giant lopsidedness to it, which maybe would have changed the conversation. I don't feel like it would have for me, but I can understand how that could change. And the thing that I feel very strongly about is that you go into marriage with the plan to stay in marriage. Donald Trump advises a prenup because he seems to have the expectation that getting into this relationship won't be a lifelong commitment.
But I wonder if that's like any lawyer, though. And not that he's a lawyer, obviously, but you know, you expect the best but plan for the worst, and that's what a prenup does.
Right. I totally get that. I get that. But speaking personally for me, and this is the kind of subject that I wouldn't suppose to tell other people how they should live their lives and manage their relationships and money. But for me, there was a psychological barrier that would have been erected if we had said, let's plan for how to divide our money at the very beginning of this. To me, I am all in on this. And that means that I am all in with everything that I've got. And what I've got is some, you know, whatever I've got, but it includes some money. And so I don't want to have that. That feels like a dividing line that I would carry through my relationship. And that's deeply uncomfortable to me. And so the one thing that we do have, for what it's worth, is we have... So my wife and I bought a 2-bedroom apartment in Brooklyn, which, you know, is a small amount of space for a large amount of money because that's Brooklyn.
One bedroom each if you get divorced.
Yeah, exactly.
One kid each.
Yeah, one kid, right. We can split everything up nicely. My wife's extended family has built a very large company. And so there was some money in a trust for her. I mean, not a ridiculous, but like there was some money and we put that money into the apartments, how we got the apartment. And her family wanted me to sign a thing saying that if we got divorced, that I wouldn't get that money. I didn't like that because there was a level of distrust built into that request. But I also don't want anybody to think that I'm in this relationship because of the money in that trust. Like, I don't want that money. I don't want your money. I don't want your money. So I signed that.
Did that affect your relationship with them?
No. No, it didn't. It didn't because we all moved on from it very quickly. But I have to say I didn't like it. It didn't feel trusting. And so, I want everything to be trusting.
So I want to unpack this in a second, but I want to, Nicole, you have a different view on prenups, I think, right?
Yes.
Has it changed?
I also haven't been married, so maybe my view isn't the right view, but
I don't think there's a right or wrong, though.
You know, I think, you know, a lot of my girlfriends who are getting married feel like this is a deal breaker. Like, they don't want to sign a prenup. Like, how could somebody force them to sign a prenup? So I just try to flip that on its head and say, like, I want my future husband, if I get married, to sign a prenup. Like, I've worked really hard. I've built my own wealth. Like, I want to protect that as well. So instead of coming to this from, like, this preconceived idea of, you know, deprivation. I come to it from almost a place of aspiration where I'm like, no, this is an empowering conversation that I'm looking forward to having.
What if the person you married is, let's just hypothetically say, a billionaire, okay? And he wants a prenup, but maybe also you want a prenup because maybe you feel like, okay, you're going to give up because a billionaire lifestyle is large. Maybe you're going to give up some of your career aspirations to support whatever he's doing. Maybe you feel then entitled to, do you take that view on a prenup as well, if it's going the other direction?
Well, I've had these conversations as well. I think that for me, when I do get married, I also want to be all in. And if I get divorced, like, I don't think I either want half of things and vice versa, because I think that that's more philosophically aligned, or nothing. Like, I don't want a prize for getting divorced. That doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah, because I think one opinion is basically if you get a prenup, it's put like you're putting an expiration date on the marriage, because you see a lot of cases where, oh, after 5 years, it doesn't apply anymore. And then in 4 years, 364 days, like, people file for divorce. Mm. So, because I bet there is some correlation. I mean, I've just heard this as advice, but I bet there is some correlation between the different time points on a prenup and divorces.
Well, that's messed up.
Yeah. But I wouldn't doubt it, because now you've put a time. Here's the thing. It's like, if you put a time on which like a prenup division expires, then what you've functionally done is put a time in which you have to make the final decision. But to me, the final decision should have been at the very start. The final decision was to get married. That's the final decision. So don't build in a secondary final decision. At that point, what you've done is psychologically trained yourself to be evaluating the relationship all the way through. Do I want to stay in this? Do I really feel right about this? Am I ready to give up my money to this person? Like, what a crazy thing to do to yourself.
Yeah.
It's like I remember I had a version of this that's not a version like this at all, but there was this time in which I had like a long-term girlfriend a long time ago, long before I met my wife. And there was a time where we were trying to decide whether or not to break up. Have you guys had an experience like this? And so you're like,
I've never had any breakup. What are you talking about? I am so successful at relationships. I'm just like, I could be Oprah practically.
Well, then I'll tell you what it's like. It's awful. You go through this relationship and you try to act the way that you did before things were wrong, but at the same time, constantly monitoring it for whether or not this is something that you want to continue in or you want to end. And you're both doing that. And you know that the other one's doing that. And it is unfixable. It's unsurvivable. The relationship will end. So why build that into something that's supposed to actually be a final decision?
But you know, Nicole, you said when we first described a situation that maybe divorces are correlated with dates and prenup, you said, oh, that's messed up. And then, you said, why put that added pressure on? And also you described your initial reasoning. Maybe a little bit, I'm wondering, is how much of this is you guys being too tied up in money being connected to the relationship, as opposed to a prenup being separate from the relationship and just a transaction when bad things happen?
It is. And, you know, friends of mine who have signed prenups, like, had a whole dinner or whatever where they threw it in the fire and they're like, we did it, it's done. And I really like having these awkward conversations. Like, I like having clarity. Like, I have some friends who are married or have kids and have no idea what their significant other makes. I think that's bananas.
That is bananas.
And so I just really like to be super upfront, and these are uncomfortable conversations. And I, you know, left network news for business because I think every story goes back to money, and it's not like the numbers and the stocks and the bonds and the yields and the spreads and the whatever wonky stuff. I think the math, like a fifth grader can do, it's the humanities part that's the most difficult part. It's so the relationships part that's most tricky.
Right. So let's say you get married, and assuming you'll get married and you want to do a prenup, and let's say you make significantly more than your new husband, and you're basically suggesting whatever you make before and after the marriage is yours, and whatever he makes before and after is his, and that's the prenup. Is that what you're
thinking? No, I don't think that doesn't have to be a prenup. A prenup can be whatever you want it to be. Prenup can be like, it's all together or it's nothing, or, you know, there are different celebrities who have had different clauses. As you know, we went through this on that episode.
Yeah, you rattled off a bunch of
like Mark Zuckerberg, I think, has some clause in his that they have to have date night or something like that. There are cheating clauses.
Or he can divorce her and get a billion. A billion for every week they didn't do a date night.
Or like cheating clauses or other things. Like it can be whatever the couple wants it to be. So my imaginary future husband, I have no idea what it's going to look like, but I know it's going to be a conversation. It's just going to be a conversation up front and you never have to have the conversation again.
Have you seen the TV series Succession on HBO? So yeah. there's a prenup in there. There's about a billionaire media family and there's a prenup conversation in there where basically she's from the family and he isn't. He's marrying into it. She's allowed to cheat. But if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, anyone who's watched Succession, Steve, I don't know. In her prenup with the guy, I forget his name, all their names, she's allowed to cheat, but he isn't, right?
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about Shiv and Tom.
Yeah.
I think it's like an open marriage, but no, he can do what he wants to do too.
But like he gets nothing in certain cases, if she cheats and she could divorce. I don't know. There was something one-sided about it, I remember. But it could, like you said, it could get really emotional, like because you start to think about all these worst case scenarios that could happen in the relationship. And so you almost can't help tying it together when you throw in all those morality clauses or relationship related clauses as opposed to just money, as opposed to making it just about math.
Yeah. And also debt. I mean, going in, you're taking somebody else's debt. So it's not just the money that you're making. Like,
Are you taking someone else's debt?
I don't
want to
take somebody's debt. I'm not.
I guess it depends on how you structure the.
I mean, you talk about
finances.
This in another podcast, but and also a lot of these laws are state by state. Like divorce in New York I sort of feel like, and this is a little bit related to like Dr. Oz was in this podcast and sometimes you have to look at the state laws because sometimes they state by state, they take care of it for you a little bit.
Yeah. But do you want the state to take care of it or do you want to take care of it?
Well, you can take care of it given what you know of the state's laws.
Sure. Or right. You can just do your own document, which is, I agree with you. I think it's a transaction that's separate from the relationship itself.
I mean, right. But this is the tricky thing about so many of these situations is that, yes, technically speaking, even if there is a business-like decision, a financial decision that is being layered over a personal relationship, it is almost impossible to take them as completely separate. I think we found in the show that Nicole is able to separate the two a lot more than I can. And so for me, what I try to do is reconcile what feels right for both sides of this. Like what is both the financially logical thing to do, but also the personally logical thing to do. And where can we meet in the middle on that? Because let's just be honest, it's not possible for everybody to separate these things. And so you have to do what's right for you, given how you know you're going to react.
I mean, so summarize what Dr. Oz said to you and his wife, Lisa.
They had the same philosophy you did, the pack one suit philosophy, is basically Jason's favorite team, the Miami Heat, going to championship.
Uh-huh. That's my great metaphor about going all in. So, right. For basketball or non-basketball fans, the Miami Heat, I grew up as a Miami Heat fan. The Miami Heat were traveling to Dallas, NBA finals. There were two games left in this series. If they won one of these two games, then they won the championship. There were two games. But of course, you do not want to lose that first game because then it's game seven and you're on the opponent's turf and the chances are against you, which means you got to win that first game. You want to win that first game. You have two shots at it. You should take the first one. And so Pat Riley, the coach of the Miami Heat, tells his team, pack one suit. Pack one suit, pack one shirt, pack one tie, one pair of underwears. Like we are going to pack for one game because that's all the time we're going to be there. We're going to win that first game and we're going home champions. And I love that metaphor. Don't pack two suits with the expectation that you might be there. Pack one suit because you're going and you're going to win the first damn time. And that's what they did. They won.
Yeah, I feel like that metaphor, I've heard it in different contexts as well. Like that's a really good, like there's no plan B. Like right. We're going to get this.
Burn the ships.
Yeah, or nothing. And
maybe
and,
I just have heavier baggage. I don't know. I pack more clothes.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Can I tell you, so I've been divorced twice, and can I tell you about what I did? So
please.
I didn't do a prenup in either one, and I didn't do a prenup for my last and final marriage that's going to last forever. But in the first one, we got divorced, but what we did was, because it was so confusing financially, and this the legal divorce happened right around the time of the financial crisis, so that made it even more confusing. It's almost like we got legally and emotionally divorced, but we put all our assets into a company we jointly owned with the idea that in good faith, we'd figure it out later. Mm-hmm. And a few years later, we did figure it out and dissolved that company. So again, this was kind of putting it at the moment of divorce, putting it in our hands instead of paying. For the entire divorce, we paid $1,000. We used a lawyer who he only had a typewriter. He didn't have a computer. He was like 90 years old and no prenup. Nothing, no divorce agreement really. It was just, we're divorced, one page, and then we did this other separate company that we moved everything into. And then we figured it out like, you know, 3 or 4 years later.
I love that. And then, you figured it out 3 or 4 years later because at that point emotions had died down and you were able to just think about it more logically?
Yeah, emotions had died down, life situations had died down, and I was, you know, making more money and we could work out more what support means. Mm. And then I was better able to sort of monetize these assets so then I could provide steady support. It was, you know, then it was just a rational decision. You would hope, I think the hope is that a couple, you know, gets into a relationship because they want to, and then they get out of a relationship and because they want to, because they avoid the negative emotions, like you did this, so I'm going to get you. And they can think through these things rationally. And it wasn't easy, but it was kind of, the end result appears more rational than it actually was, but that was the end result. And then the second divorce, I basically gave her everything. So 100%, just knowing that I know how to make money and I'll figure it out. I kind of jumped into the deep end of the swimming pool and she was having some issues and I wanted her to be okay. So I just gave her everything and then started from scratch.
That's a bold move.
Yeah, it was bold. It was scary.
Not casual.
So.
Well, I think thinking about getting married, you might want to not marry somebody you don't want to be divorced from.
Yeah. But sometimes, though, things happen. Like, you know, and I'm not even saying one person cheats and the other person doesn't. Sometimes just there's all sorts of situations that could happen that could end a marriage in today's society. So people could just leave and just decide they don't want to be with the other person. So, you know, it gets complicated. So you kind of have to think a little bit like, oh, what if this ends, particularly if there's a huge imbalance in money or earning potential. But I don't know, really. I guess the point is, there's, like with many money issues, there's no real answer. And it depends on how deeply intertwined certain emotions you have are about these, you know, money situations.
Yeah, certainly. And I think with a lot of this stuff, you're informed by your own experience or what you've seen around you. And for me, I come from my parents have been married since 1976, and happily so. So that's the model that I come from. And also throughout my life, I've put myself in a number of situations where there was kind of no plan B and it worked out okay. And so that also makes me it emboldens me to continue moving forward with just plan A.
Well, aren't you lucky with the plan A?
So far. So far.
Nicole, you grew up in a radically
fucked
different
up
situation. And how does this inform your opinion on prenups and other issues that we're going to get to?
Yeah. I mean, you can't, no pun intended, divorce your situation from your current feelings. I think that I am a product of divorce and a super broken home. And, you know, I think for me, I always want to have my own back. And so I believe in love. I believe in marriage. And I'm not jaded. Like, I've had a lot of life experience, but I haven't been broken by it. And so I'd love to, you know, pack one suit, but you don't go into a job thinking you're going to get fired or you're going to get laid off or your department's going to be let go. You don't go into these things thinking, you know, that's going to happen, but sometimes it does. And so I just have always come to these issues with having my own back.
Okay, well, another issue I'll just throw out there because it was one of your podcast issues, loaning money to a friend. Nicole, can I borrow some money before you leave here, like $1,000? Can I just
No, but you can have it.
All right.
See, this is how I have
I'll take a check for ACH transfer.
Venmo. Jason says, hell no.
Well, no, I say sure as long as you're gonna pay me back. Which I feel like you would pay me back. We're in a nice living room here. Seems like you reasonably could pay me back. Yeah, Nicole is totally down for the handout. Thanks, says the world, for your various handouts. But that's because she doesn't want the expectation that comes with a loan that could be disappointing and harm the relationship to impact the relationship. I'm totally fine to lend somebody money, but if they come to me and ask me for a loan, then we treat it like a loan. Then it's got to come back to me. And
would you draw up a contract? Would you put in interest payments? Or would you have the loan backed by real assets? Like the way a traditional loan is done?
Well, no, but nobody's ever come to me asking for enough money that would be necessary. Right? Like I mean, people have asked me for some money, you know, but not like so much money that I would feel like I need to protect myself by some kind of like document need.
But you know, you're with the prenup stuff.
Yeah.
You said how the prenup, a loan is essentially a contract. You're giving money and you expect at some future date to get the money back. And there might be other conditions like interest, or if they don't pay back, they do X or whatever. And the prenup is also a contract, like some financial arrangement is met and then there might be an end point. And you said you don't want the relationship to be burdened by all of this kind of financial fencing around it. And, you know, but here you're willing to be burdened, whereas Nicole isn't. Like you don't want to take the risk that the friendship will be, I'm looking at Nicole, this is on, if you're listening on audio, you don't want to take the risk, Nicole, that your friendship might be burdened by this new financial filter on top of it, but you're willing to take that risk. You assess like a bank manager that the friendship can handle that risk.
So I'm looking at it in a couple ways. Number one, if a friend comes to you and asks for a loan, they have already altered the friendship in some way, haven't they? Like they introduced the concept. You either have to say yes or no, or I suppose yes in Nicole's case, here's $1,000, you don't have to pay me back. And
but they do often.
They do, right. Because they'd feel bad. I mean, who doesn't feel awkward to have it? But they're putting you in a situation where you have to say yes or no. So they're already altering the friendship in some way. So now I'm starting from that point. So now what is the way that I think can best respect both of our needs? And if they're asking me for a loan, then they're asking to have some money that they would pay back. I'm not going to charge a friend interest. And also I would be totally fine on it coming back to me in quite a while if I knew that they were being responsible. But I don't want to feel taken advantage of, I think is what it really comes down to. And the difference between being willing to put that kind of infrastructure around a friendship versus a marriage is that we all know that friendships can come and go. And that just is part of life. Whereas the one relationship that you really want to do your best to make sure that it doesn't come and go is I guess, family and, you know, in marriage. So
would the amount of money that you're willing to lend change if it was like a sibling versus a friend? Because siblings don't come and go. I mean, they do, but not the
same way.
I would
totally lend I have a sister. She has never asked me for a loan, nor do I think she would need it. But I would totally, I'd help her out to a far greater extent. I think I would just give her money if she needed it.
Because I think I also don't want to be disappointed, and I have been disappointed in the past. Because all these things, we all do good things and we all make mistakes. So my guess, maybe you've lent money in the past and you just didn't get it back. So now you're just like, screw it, you'll give it. Nicole, has that happened?
I mean, there's this old adage that if you lend your friend money, you have to decide which you want more.
The friendship or the money? Or there's another one. If you never want to see someone again, lend the money.
You know, I am a big gifter. So like gifting is one of my love languages. It's definitely not one of Jason's.
Nope.
But I, you know, if somebody needs something and they're a really good friend, as you guys know, like truly my friends are my family. And so if they're going to ask me for it, like they need it. And mm-hmm. so I'm going to give it to them. And so I know that the character of my friends is one typically that will give it back to me anyway. Don't we have to, like, I'm not bank lapping. Like, I'm not coming up with like basis points that they have to give me back.
Like, what percent of your net worth would you give a friend in need?
Woo.
Interesting. I have never been confronted with that. I don't know. I'm so giving. I may put myself, you know, in a difficult situation to help somebody else, depending if it came to something like that. If somebody really needed it, like I would go to the mat and play in traffic and ride or die, or I don't know, like give me an example. If somebody really needed a significant amount of money, like I could change my lifestyle if they were that important to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like let's say someone was going broke, they were going to have to, I don't know, go
get surgery or whatever. Like, but that, to me, like my girlfriends are my sisters. And so it would be the same conversation as like if your sister really like needed a kidney. Or, like,
and yet we all go on Patreon sometimes and support either causes or artistic ventures or even entrepreneurial ventures that we believe in. That's kind of equivalent to just giving a friend money.
Yeah. Because it's a different context. Like, I think context is really important here. So I'm not like miserly about it. If it's not like if I go out to dinner with a friend and I pick up the check that I expect them to pay me back, right? We're going out to dinner. It's fine. It's not like I'm keeping track of money in that way. But the approach of, hey, can you loan me money, is a setup in which there is a given a return. And that's where again, it comes down to me. I don't want to feel taken advantage of. So if there's a situation in which money is exchanged where there's no like taking advantage, paying for dinner if you go out with a friend, or somebody's in trouble or whatever, and they set up a GoFundMe and you give them money, like there's no expectation at that point. I'm not going to feel taken advantage of because the setup from the beginning. Yeah.
Right. It's a different kind of contract.
Right.
So, I mean, I could say, every time I've, not counting the GoFundMes and the patrons, every time I've either given or loaned a fairly substantial amount to someone close to me, it's 100% of the time turned into a disaster, giving or loaned. And it could be because maybe I didn't respect the money enough. Maybe I wasn't a good judge of character, although it's hard when it's with family.
But then what, looking back on those moments, what was the solve? Was the solve to not give them money in the first place? Was the solve to just give them money and not expect it to come back?
I don't know. Like, so here's, can I give you an example?
Yeah.
So, because maybe your advice will help me to never do it again. Although, is Robin here? Yeah, so Robin will never let me do it again. She's much different than me on this. She's very good at...
anyway. Boundaries?
Boundaries, yes. So, very good friend of mine, probably it was like 2008 or 2007 or 2009, I forget, but probably you knew. I think he was a mutual friend of ours, Nicole. Was going broke, needed to borrow some money, was kind of living a slightly larger lifestyle than he needed to. He needed to borrow a decent amount. He promised he would pay back in 6 months. Of course, he didn't pay back in 6 months. I didn't bring it up because I didn't want him to feel bad. He ended up leaving New York, moving far away. And during the course of the next couple of years, I gave him an idea to make money, which worked for him. And he made a very quick money, let's just say 25 or 30 times the amount I lent him, which was already a pretty substantial amount. And so I said to him, I called him one day, and this is like 4 or 5 years after I lent him the money, and I'd never asked about it, bro. I said, by the way, remember that one time you asked to borrow and I lent you the money, and now you've made all of this money. Maybe now is a good time to give it back. And he's like, I don't remember borrowing money from you. And he had to remember, because someone's going to remember when they're going broke and they borrow like this kind of money from someone. And he was a really good friend. Like, he was one of my closest friends. And so he says, but if you say I did, I'll pay you back. I'll pay you back. I trust you. You say you lent it. So I said, yeah, I lent it to you. Pay it back. He paid it back. And then I never spoke to him again.
Man.
And I didn't go to his marriage.
Wow.
I never communicated with him again. He never responded to hundreds of emails. Because I felt like, I don't know, this betrayal somehow. Like, it was just weird to me. When something gets weird, I don't like it. But maybe I shouldn't have lent. Maybe I should have had a contract if I was actually expecting the money back as opposed to just giving it. Maybe I should have attached it to this business idea I gave him, although I didn't really need, you know, to benefit from that. Or maybe I should have forgiven him. I don't know what the answer is.
I think it worked out okay for you. I think you got your money back and you found out that this dude is a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And you're not friends.
That's how I view it. That's why to this day, this is like 10 years later, he still reaches out. He doesn't understand, but it's not my obligation to explain it either. And
just send him a link to this episode of the podcast.
That's right.
He might not recognize himself.
Yeah, that's true.
So, and then also I've given to family and whatever family member, they've always forgotten and never remembered and didn't trust me that I gave. And so that would affect familial relationships.
Yeah.
So, I've never heard the forgotten. Like, who forgets that?
I know.
That's such a silly,
what a terrible excuse.
Can't you do better?
Like, right.
Yeah, I know. But people do.
Right. Or you literally are the kind of person for whom a friend giving
you
money.
Scoffing.
No, I just remembered, yeah, James, you gave me the money. Thanks.
Just be like, have good, like, that's such a sign of your character. You don't want people in your life like that.
Yeah, that's true. It's a good litmus test for the friendship. I mean, that's awful. I don't know that there's anything that you could have done better outside of that you learned that this was a friend.
Maybe I could have just said, though, this is just a gift and I should just not have, because it wasn't later on when I finally asked for it back, it wasn't that big a deal to me. It was actually a big deal to me at the time when I lent it. But when I asked for it back, it wasn't a big deal, but I just felt it was fair to give it back, particularly since I'd helped to make him come back from the grave, essentially.
See, this is where, you know, to go back to the thing I said earlier, like if you understand what your philosophy is, if you're able to confront your own feelings on money enough that you know how you think and react to money, then it will help guide you through a situation like this. So for me, at least, there's no way that I could have given what sounds like a substantial amount of money to a friend, even if I framed it as a gift. I just would have expected something in return. And I couldn't, just that they walked away from it and then never tried to give it back to me or whatever. Even if I called it a gift, I totally would have expected it back.
Right. So it's interesting because I think my problem was, and this relates to just how I think about the energy of money. Like there's three skills to money: making it, keeping it, and growing it. And they're mutually exclusive skills. Mm. So I've always been good at making it in one way or the other. I'm kind of like, I have, not that I have any special skills in them, but I have a bunch of skills together that help me make. But in terms of it took me a long time to figure out the skills, even the beginning skills of keeping it. And I think I let things just slip through like sand too easily. And so I didn't respect it enough when I made it, like how hard it was to make. And, you know, so lending or giving or all these things, I didn't really put the right boundaries on it somehow. I don't know. There's like nuances of what I could have done differently. Like maybe I shouldn't have done it at all. I said, look, I'm going through my own thing. I can't do it. Sorry. Maybe I could have just done it as a gift. Maybe I could have put a contract around it. And then it's sort of natural almost that I'm going to be betrayed afterwards just because I didn't respect it going out. How could I respect that it's going to come back in?
Huh.
I don't know if that makes sense. It's sort of like a woo-woo way to look at money, but I kind of think money is an energy.
It is.
And it converts into this world, and that energy converts into this world in terms of money, in terms of currency.
And Jason and I talk about this often. Mm. He doesn't like my woo-woo take on money energy either.
I just can't get into woo-woo at all.
But I think that when you need money, it's actually better to give more money out because it comes back to you.
Yeah, or
it's sort of the law of attraction.
Or to put your mind in that mode where you're being very creative about how you could help others make it. It's going to be natural that it's not even in this, you know, new age way. It's just like if you're in that mode where it's about money creation, even for somebody else, it's going to cycle around. Like you're going to be in those waters.
Yeah. So. Well, I will offer a non-woo-woo agreement, which is that also if you're in the process of, if you're helping somebody do anything, if you're talking them through whatever, for me, a lot of people want to sit down and have like career conversations because of what I do at Entrepreneur. And I find that talking them through this kind of stuff also just helps me think through my own career stuff because it puts you in that mindset, and money and career and anything is also a lot of just pattern recognition. It's just thinking through problems and seeing how they're solved and thinking through how ideas are generated and executed. And by helping somebody else, you put yourself through that mentality too. And that's valuable.
Right. But I think the flip side of it is when you're not really thinking about money creation, but it's just like sort of just spewing out of you, like in just every direction in random haphazard ways. And, you know, that's as opposed to kind of this very concentrated, like, okay, ideas, you're going to do this business, you're going to do this business, I'm going to do this. You know, that's like a more organized, you know, philosophical way to view money. Like you were saying, you have to have your core principles. I feel like initially I didn't have. So it's like, okay, he needs to borrow, but she needs a gift. And okay to yes to all, like why not? And then, like you said, you expect it back because you have a disciplined way of thinking about it. I had no disciplined discussions or thoughts or anything. It was just, it was more all fear-based. Like, yeah, of course, well, I'm going to give this person money because I don't want them to go bankrupt. And of course, I'm going to loan my friend money because I don't want him to not like me. You know, I might have been all screwed up about everything.
Well, but that's most people. This is why I like talking money with Nicole, because Nicole has like spends her career talking and writing and thinking about this. And I really don't. I found that stick me in a room with Nicole and force me to talk about this, that I have positions that I like fall back on, but I haven't really thought a lot of them out. I haven't articulated a lot of them. And that is so, I just found that to be an extremely valuable process for myself. And then I hope other people do it too, because you don't really know what it is that you think until you're put up against a situation that you have to react to. And then the next thing that you should do is step back and try to articulate why you reacted that way.
So, okay, so this is a smaller issue, I think, but it's an interesting one because I think a lot of people view this, in my opinion, incorrectly, but tipping. You've done an episode on tipping. Well, you know, should it be mandatory already on the check? Should it be something you choose? You know, and every country's got different either laws or cultural values about this. Like, what's your view on tipping?
I turn to Nicole.
I love tipping. And I, going back to the woo-woo-ness, like, I think when I am in worse financial situations, the more I give and the more generous I am, the more it comes back to me. And so I generally like to be a big tipper. And Jason feels very uncomfortable around all things tipping.
I hate it.
But now I think by the nature of our show, there's more clarity around how you feel.
Yes.
And I think generally we don't use cash, we decided on the show, but we're going to advocate for card companies to hook up more points because we had the points guy on for this episode, Brian Kelly.
We had a big idea, that just got thrown out on the show, and somebody needs to do it. I'm going to say it again here so that somebody makes this happen. Why don't credit card companies give bonus points for the tip? Like, You get single points for the meal, but then whatever you put on the tip should be bonus or triple points.
I love
that
idea.
Yeah.
It's a win for everybody. It's a PR victory for everybody.
That's right. And give, folks Squares or Venmo or whatever, like when you're at hotels with the bellmen, like, because I would give, and homeless people, if they had Squares, I would totally give so much money
right.
away.
So let's think about this from a policy point of view. It's more revenues for the credit card company because ultimately
they're getting a percentage on it.
Right. They get the percentage first, and the points, as we know, is the float, like an insurance company. It's how Warren Buffett makes his money, is always investing in businesses with these. You get the money up front, but you don't have to spend it maybe for years. And a lot of people forget to spend their points. So it's a win for the credit card company. They'll make more money. It's a win. It's a almost from a public policy point of view, it's a win for the bottom third of the economy because, you know, the ones who make part of their living on tips, whether it's a driver or a waitress or a waiter or whatever, they make more money, right? So that brings up the income, it solves income inequality in its extreme version. And it's a win for the individual tipping because it becomes more natural to tip bigger. And then you'll get, you know, the idea theoretically of tipping is that you get treated better next time you're at the place and so on.
Right. And people are rewarded for doing something nice. And wouldn't it be nice to live in a world in which people just always did the right nice thing but let's be real, people do it often in part because they get something back too.
But it's not so bad that the nice natural thing to do is also has incentives on every side.
Totally. Like, that's fine. I think it's great. Reward people for doing nice things. People should be rewarded for doing nice things.
Yeah, and also capitalism. People are rewarded for innovation.
Yeah.
And then that's why we have, you know, someone like Elon Musk makes rocket ships. He doesn't do it for free. He makes money doing it.
Right. It's just such a PR victory. Chase, MasterCard, somebody, get in touch. Like, do this. It's such a PR victory. Everyone will write about it. The ads write themselves. It is awesome. You should do it. And I just want to, because we've gone a few minutes with me just continuing to say, I hate tipping. But then I didn't explain just so that people don't hate me. I tip. But what I hate
12%.
Is...
12%.
Come on. No, I tip nicely. I tip. I'm a very fine tipper. But the thing that I hate is that we are expected as consumers to place some kind of financial judgment upon everybody who does some service for us. I hate that. What I would rather is that everybody just get paid more and then you just give me one price. The thing that I just kept repeating when Nicole and I were talking about it, just tell me what it costs. I don't want to make a decision about what it costs. You tell me what it costs and I will pay that. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, because I guess sometimes tipping is very stressful. So like if you're staying in a hotel, do you tip every single person who walks by you or who opens the car door for you or whatever? That gets confusing. And also if you live particularly in Manhattan or anywhere, if you live in a doorman building, how do you... I've talked to the people in this building. Every single person I've talked to has a different philosophy of how they're going to tip. And they're convinced everyone's doing it the same way that they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just gathering all the information because I'm going to tip more than all of them. So I win. So everybody will like me the most.
Yeah.
Because that's maybe, it's like, I don't know.
It's a good move.
What I think is always, like, let's say you're at a restaurant. And the meal, and you're buying meal for someone, meal comes to $100. And everybody, they say on the receipt, here's what 18% is, here's what 14% is, here's what 22% is. I sort of feel like for the average person, you know, there's no real, like 20% is $20. That's considered a good tip, right? But 30% would be considered, because people think in percentages, 30% is like considered a mind-blowingly large tip, but it's actually only $10 more. So I figured I can buy mind-blowing for a trivial amount of money. So it's like I'm just tipping an above average percentage for a relatively little amount, I get to buy mind-blowing. So if I'm ever in the restaurant again, they remember.
I love that. And do they? Is there an ROI on mind-blowing?
Yeah, there is. And like, for instance, at the local cafe I go to, I always get a free coffee and no one minds if I work on my laptop there all morning, whereas they do seem to mind with other people.
Mm.
And it works in almost every situation. I'll tell you one other thing I do with tipping. Most of the time, not every time, but most of the time in cash situations, I will tip exclusively with $2 bills. So then they definitely remember. They remember that you gave more.
Yeah.
And they remember that you're that guy with the $2 bills.
Yes, that is true. That is smart. So, that's using it to your advantage.
Because each $2 bill is worth a little bit more emotionally.
Sure.
To someone. So again, I'm buying value.
Which is memorable.
So what do you do? Like, you have a whole stack of $2
bills?
I go to the bank
every few months and I say I'd like, let's say, 1,000 $2 bills. And then they call the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve literally sends them like a packet of 1,000 $2 bills.
That's amazing. When you gave
and
me
And I've been doing this for 30 years.
That's a lot of $2 bills.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So but it's paid dividends.
What do you say? What do you just like? You just
it
keep,
has.
You just keep a bunch of them in your wallet at any time?
Yeah, yeah. Or I have just a box filled with them.
Yeah.
And then I reach into the box when I'm going out and use that money.
When you gave me your, I don't know if it was most recent book, but you gave me a book and you had a bookmark which was North Korean won? What is the
currency? It was 100 North Korean won.
Yeah.
And legal tender, by the way, in North Korea.
Yeah.
It had Kim Jong-il, I think was the grandfather, was on it. And it is 100 won. It still could be spent in North Korea. It cannot be spent here because of trade sanctions.
Right.
So be careful. But yeah, I like to collect weird dictator money also.
Oh.
But not,
how do you
not
get that?
Not the big guys, not Hitler, Stalin, or Mao, but pretty much anyone else.
Yeah, how did you get that?
There's auctions, there's like currency auctions where they'll just sell some, like for instance, one guy I reached out to, he was like the first soldier in Saddam Hussein's palace, and there was tons of suitcases just filled with currency in the expectation that somebody would be running, and he just took one of the suitcases and has been selling off all of this 2001 issued, you know, dinars, Iraqi dinars.
Oh my God. Wait, is this like on eBay? Where are these auctions happening?
No, there's like auction sites for currency. There's different sites. So, and you can even find them on Amazon, but I think they're a little more expensive on Amazon.
Yeah.
So I prefer getting them in auctions because I like to buy good amounts so that I don't run out.
Dictatordollars.com. You should launch it.
Yeah,
that sounds
exactly.
Like a side hustle. A side hustle.
It could be, yeah. I mean, they're not really worth that much. So it's just a fun thing.
Yeah.
So
dirty money.
Yeah, because I'll find, it's funny with the North Korean won is that I'll give it to somebody and some people will back away. Like they'll put their hands up. They actually, you could tell they physically don't want to touch it as if you're handing them like a cockroach or something.
Well, I didn't know, I don't know if you remember this, but I like took it back to my office and I'm like staring at this thing. And then I wanted to share it on social because it's so cool. And then I wasn't sure if it was legal for me to have it. And I didn't know if I would be outing you for having, so I emailed you to ask if it was okay for me to share this on social that you had given this to me. And you were like, yeah, go for it. But I didn't know what strings are attached to this.
Yeah,
thing.
I think maybe that's why, like some people, I, again, smart people, I actually don't understand why they wouldn't. I said, why wouldn't you touch it? And because I'll like push it at them and like, I just don't want to touch it. And there's no one's giving me an actual reason why. It's like 20% of the people won't touch this kind of currency.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. But okay, this gets into another topic, which is gifting. So what do you think about gifts? Which is a complicated topic.
I love gifts. Like I said, gifting is one of my love languages. And I will buy Jason gifts, whether he likes it or not. But he does not like it.
I do not.
He's like the only person on the planet who doesn't like gifts.
Yeah. So,
no, I don't like getting gifts.
Really?
Yeah.
Why,
two people on the planet. Anybody
here
else?
We are.
Who likes?
Yeah, the rest of the room enjoys gifts.
I like gifts.
Yeah, we're all into gifts.
I like
giving gifts.
Do you like giving
gifts?
I
like giving gifts.
But you don't like receiving gifts because it makes you feel weird.
Yeah, it makes me feel weird. It makes me feel like I don't know how to respond to the person.
This is it.
Wow, you guys are like,
this is it.
Brothers from another mother.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. It feels like it's some burden has been put upon me to do something in return and I don't know what that thing is.
Yeah.
Also, I'm a very bad gift giver. So I don't feel like I have the skills to properly respond.
See, I think I'm a good gift giver, which actually means I rarely give gifts because it's hard to find the right gift for a person in situation. So I can't it's hard to just go to a bookstore and buy someone a book and give it to them because they could just buy it on Kindle or they could buy it themselves or whatever.
That's why you get weird currency. Like, or you just find a gift and just keep giving the same weird, quirky,
No, because it's got to be like a narrative. Like, why am I giving this gift to this person?
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, I used a very good literary agent to sell my latest book. I hadn't used a literary agent in a long time and she really went above and beyond. Like, I was really super impressed. So what I did was I had to go, Robin and I, we went to an antique store on, I think, 29th Street. And down in the basement, I knew of one guy who sold antique dial phones, like from the 60s. So we got this like classic olive green rotary phone from the 60s. And I sent that as a gift to the agent because I said, oh, you were so good at making phone calls. This is like back to the basics. So there's like a narrative to the gift.
I like that.
I like it.
I think that was a good move.
Yeah. It's like, then it makes gift giving like feels artistic somehow. But yeah, in general, that's hard. Like, I have to go someplace. I have to think of something.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be something done that was deserving of this.
But what if I, like, after this episode, I was like, James, so good to reconnect. Whatever. Here's like a suitcase of weird dictator money. Like, you'd feel weird about it? Or you'd be like, this chick is so awesome.
I mean, I'd probably, I think I would feel a little weird about it. But now that you just said it, she said she would do that. So
now the door's open. See, but you've actually presented it. I hadn't thought about this, but this is a situation in which I would not feel awkward about giving a gift, which is receiving the thank you gift. Like, if you did something, if you worked together on something, there was some success, and you know that that person wants to thank you for the work that you did, and they send you a gift. This is wonderful because then it feels like the loop has been closed by me receiving the gift. I don't have to do anything in response to receiving the gift.
Yeah, but I don't know because, again, by the way, for people who have given me gifts in the past, I've always been super appreciative. And then what happens is I don't know how to respond and I delay responding. And then after a week, I feel, okay, I'll do it next week. I'll respond. And then after a month, it'll be like, ugh, I should really respond. He gave me or she gave me such a nice gift. And then next thing I know, it's 5 years later and I haven't spoken to them. So that's really my problem with getting the gifts. Because, you know, if you occasionally, in our business, you get gifts from like readers or listeners. And I'm always super appreciative, but I just don't know how to respond. And I'm not very good with, I don't know, responding. I can barely return phone calls, let alone respond to a gift.
But how is that loop open if I'm like, yo, Jason, here's a birthday present. Like, that's your birthday, period, end of story.
Because the like, next thing that happens is that you
my
have
birthday?
A birthday.
But yeah. I'm not, it's not a quid pro quo. Like,
I know, but it feels like it. It feels like an ongoing thing. What's going to happen now? Are you going to give me a birthday present every year? Do I have to start giving you back? There's an openness to this that makes me feel like gifting is now part of the relationship. I don't want it to be part of the relationship.
But you know, that's your own shit. That's your own anxiety.
But the birthday thing's weird too, because now we know so many people because of Facebook and we know all the time when their birthdays are, that it's like every day, all day, you could be just like, happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday. And then there are people in your life where like, okay, oh, it's a busy day for me, but I got to call this person by the end of the day or else he or she's going to be really upset because this was the one day a year she wants to talk to me is on her birthday and she takes it real seriously. And so I've lost like relationships, friendships, because I don't call a person on their birthday. It's even that is like a lot. Like I don't like doing things that are expected.
I don't call people
That's
on their
why
birthday
I like
either.
Unexpected gifts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I try to come up with creative ones, especially after meetings and stuff like that. Like, I think we talked about that. I gave somebody who talked about in a production meeting a cat poo coffee from Bali and like tracked that down and sent it.
And some cultures, like, have you ever had any meetings with like Japanese companies? There's always an exchange of gifts.
Oh, yeah, right.
When you meet a Japanese company for business reasons. And I've gotten like the oddest gifts.
Like what?
So I had a company that made websites in the 90s and there was some Japanese magazine that visited me. They wanted a website and they also wanted to interview I was making websites for a lot of entertainment companies. So they wanted to have access to those entertainment companies. So they come, they barely speak English. They have a translator and they give me a gift of like a box of condoms. So And I don't know why.
I was not expecting
like,
that.
Seems like an odd gift.
Yeah. Well,
like,
they wanted you to be safe.
Hmm?
They wanted you to be safe.
Yeah, yeah. They wanted me to be, I just got married too. So it was like an odd gift. And they didn't know that. They didn't know one thing or the other about me. So.
Huh.
Fascinating.
You know, but I will endorse through this conversation, I've realized both of you have given me like small gifts that I would categorize less as even gifts and more as like amusing tokens. Nice tokens, right? Which is which was the North Korean won from you, James. And then for Nicole, she sent me a nameplate, which I know is a thing you do for people where it's like, you know, a little nameplate that you put on your desk. You know, it's like, has your name and then a title. And so it says, Jason Pfeiffer, Boss Bitch, which is the name of her book. And I love it. It's on my desk. It's great. And so
it's
like...
It's a great talking piece.
It's a great talking piece. Michelle Pfeiffer, when she was in my office, was so into it. And then Nicole made one for Michelle.
Excuse me. Was that a name drop? We should have like
no,
a
no. Hello,
for like
it's right. not. You're reading into this. It's like Pfeiffer, as in Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
It's like his sister from another mister.
Really?
You know, probably if you go far enough back.
All right.
Ask AJ Jacobs.
Fair
he'll
enough.
Figure it out.
Fair enough.
But I like those things because they were fun and they were like interesting to me. But also, I knew that they didn't put either of you out very much. Right? It's like it cost.
Okay.
However much it was within a dollar or two, right?
But I like, and I'm serious about this, I it's going to sound like I'm not, but I like how you viewed the 100 North Korean won as a gift, but it was a bookmark in one of my books that I had written that I was giving you.
Yeah.
So that was just like, oh yeah, of course he's going to give me his book. But like
right.
the bookmark, man, that was a gift.
Yeah, it is. Because the book, if you know,
So we
all know authors.
We
are all authors. We know we got a lot of books. We've got a lot of books, and part of the thing that we want to do is give our books to people. So, so that felt perfectly reasonable, a regular exchange. But then that was a little added something. That was something different,
right? I think the something different is interesting, but again, I still don't like. I give it rarely, and I still don't like getting because then I don't know how to respond. But going to say something, but I forget what it is now.
But this is like a different episode because both of those gifts were like James and I just trying to pimp out our books and like do it in creative ways and
That's
memorable
true.
Ways. So this is another episode
so both,
on how
think,
to get your
you're both
book
good marketers,
noticed but, by an editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine.
Although, I think again, there's a certain creativity to the gift and there's a narrative to it somehow. And I think that's always fun if it's planned in the right way and if it's done rarely. So,
right. So the great, you know what the great lesson, the great takeaway from this, from that, I hadn't even thought about that, but you're totally right. The great is like when you're, if you're pitching your thing to somebody, be value forward about what they get.
Yeah,
totally.
That is what connects. That's what people remember. I have a million people have given me their books, and most of them, unless I'm actual friends with them, most of the books end up in the closet at Entrepreneur, and then get donated to Housing Works eventually. But your books, and your doodads that you've given me are all they're with me.
Yeah.
Okay, what do you do though? Like this happens to me mm-hmm. a lot. Somebody will meet me at a conference, whatever, and give me their book that they. Self-published and it's not even stapled together correctly and they'll give me their book and it's like you have to read it. Can I call you next week to talk about this and how I can like you know I'm sure you'll love it. You're gonna want to make toys around this and then I can never talk to that person again because I'm never gonna read the book.
I have a moment that haunts me about that. It's not a big moment, but it's like you know these little things that pop out of your mouth and which is that we were at I was speaking at a conference. And my book was on sale at the conference. And afterwards, a guy bought my book. And then he came up to me to give me his book. And he said something like that. He was like, I'll make you a deal. I'll read your book and you'll read my book. And what I should have just said, just to be generous, was that's a deal. But instead, the thing that popped out of my mouth was, I'll try. Because I'm busy, and honestly, that was the answer.
That's a good answer.
But then they keep talking to you.
No, but that's such a. I thought as soon as I said it, I was like, "What a dick move that was." I'll try. Like this guy bought my book, and he's giving me his book for free, and I'm like, "Yeah, I'll try to read your book." I hate that I said that, but that is what.
And what would you rather say? Yes, like call me on Tuesday.
I would have just been like, "It's a deal." I don't know
that
he would have expected me to do it.
Might not be a lie. He doesn't know.
Yeah,
maybe he opens up. He's like, "Oh my God, this is." This is the new Shakespeare. So listen, your podcast is Hush Money. You did season one. How many episodes altogether were in season one? I forget.
12.
12
season one.
Then we've got
every topic was like fascinating.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Interesting. And I'm always interested in the connection between sort of like life energy, not in a woo-woo way, but I do think your life, how you view life and how you view money are interwoven together. And all of these issues touch upon that. And when does season two start?
In the spring.
Spring. What are some of the topics we can look forward to?
Oh, what do we got? We got, should couples combine finances? Should you work for free?
Boom. I want to be the guest judge on that one.
Come.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I actually have strong thoughts about that.
About working for free?
Yeah.
For or against?
Well, when I judge your responses, I'll decide.
That's what they call a tease in podcasting. Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think we all worked for free in some way or another at some point?
Yeah, definitely.
Probably.
Totally.
Yeah. So yeah, so in the spring, we haven't set a date yet, but we're recording them now. We're talking in December. So whenever people listen to this, it's coming.
And what else going on? Nicole, I forgot to mention, you've written like 2 New York Times bestselling books. Boss Bitch. What was the other?
Rich Bitch was the first. Boss Bitch, Becoming Superwoman just came out. Superwoman Journal came out with it. Rich Bitch came back out again because it saw this resurgence or whatever this year.
Oh, that's great.
That's it.
Get all of Nicole's books.
All the bitches.
Get them all.
And what else are you working on right now, Jason? I mean, obviously you're working on an entire magazine that you have to put out every month. And I'm saying, what, and a podcast. And I'm saying, what additional stuff can you just give to us for almost nothing?
His presence is our gift.
Yes, exactly. The gifts that I will not give you because I don't like giving gifts. I guess 2 things. One, in case anybody's interested in a romantic comedy about 2 people who sleep together each week and then critically review each other's performance in a magazine, then I have Mr. Nice Guy, which is a novel that I wrote with my wife. And then also, I've got this podcast called Pessimist Archive, which is a history of why people resist new things, which is my second favorite podcast.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And I didn't know about that one. Is that ongoing?
Yeah, that's ongoing. It's a monthly show. It comes out every
month. What's some of the topics on that?
The one that we just came out with was teddy bears. Teddy bears, extremely controversial in 1907. The argument was, teddy bears were brand new at the time, and the argument was that teddy bears are going to replace dolls, and without dolls, young girls will not develop a maternal instinct, and thus the human race will end.
Man, that sounds like just the doll military-industrial complex getting down on
exactly.
Teddy bears.
Big doll.
Yeah, big doll was like shafting the teddy bear. So, all right, well, I'm going to start listening. That sounds fun.
Thanks.
And thanks for coming on the podcast. After season 2, will you come on again? Because we can talk about all these issues. And then there's some of the issues I even wanted to talk about with season 1, but we're out of time. But check out the Should You Be in a Relationship with Someone in Debt. I think that's an interesting episode and concept.
And who pays on a first date?
Hmm?
Who pays on a first date?
Oh, the man pays on a first date.
Yep. Agreed.
Oh man. I hold myself back so that we don't go on for another.
Which, by the way,
we ended the podcast on when you said, "Oh man," that was the end of the podcast.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match 2 of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.